From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 10 years ago, 2008, when the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester welcomed a new bishop. The church welcomed a man who has studied and taught in places around the world. The Right Reverend Dr. Prince Singh became the eighth bishop of the Episcopal Diocese here in Rochester, completing a long journey that started in his birthplace of Chennai, you might know it as Madras, India. Bishop Singh has become a consistent voice in our community, calling for interfaith dialogue and understanding and bridging cultural differences. He recently helped lead a prayer service for families separated at the southern U.S. border. At a time when we are divided by our many differences, Bishop Singh thinks churches can do more to help bring people together. And that gives us a lot to discuss today. It's the first time he's been with me here in the studio, so it's my honor to have him, the Right Reverend Dr. Prince Singh, 8th Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Evan.
I want to know the formal title here. Dr. Singh, the Right Reverend, Reverend Singh, Bishop Singh. Tell me what to use.
Prince is a title.
Well, that's your name. How's Bishop Singh? Is that okay with you?
Bishop Singh's fine.
Well, it's really great to have you here. And this is a time where we could talk about so many things, but I think I want to start with what you and I were discussing briefly before the hour began, which is the observation that you've made not only here in Rochester, but in your travels around the world, in your work around the world, probably in conversations with colleagues around the world, you see nationalism impacting our community, but you see a lot of parallels in places around the world, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Tell me about that.
Well, actually, I want to start by saying the reason I notice it is because one of the core values in the faith that I practice, which is practicing following Jesus, there is a clear vision of belonging categorized as building beloved community, where every person matters and belongs. So when you come to look at the world through a lens like beloved community, you start to notice fragmentations when they occur. And one of the manifestations I see in our time of such a fragmentation or alienation is through a practice of nationalism that is becoming more and more normative around the world. I saw that growing up in India with a rising quote-unquote Hindu fundamentalism ideology, which divided people and started to create more of us and them, those within and those outside. And then, of course, I notice it more and more in our world, whether it's Brexit or the rising sense of white supremacy or the divisions that exist in our society per se, in terms of racial divisions, economic divisions, gender discriminations that happen around the world and in our communities. It is prevalent and it's sort of becoming more and more of a norm. That's the concern that I have.
Is there a singular reason more than any other that you would pin for the cause of that?
I think probably fear.
Fear?
Fear of the other. And the tendency to somehow feel that virtual or illusionary sense of security by creating an us and them dichotomy seems to drive human behaviors to increasingly move in that direction of saying, if I am with this group, I am superior and hence safer.
Take me back to your childhood growing up. What do you remember about a society, a large bustling society with, someone like me? I certainly can't speak to what life would have been like in Madras for you growing up. Were there religious divisions that you recall? I mean, you talk about Hindu fundamentalism as it started to rise, but beyond that, was there respect for pluralism? Was there respect for differences? Were there divides even when you were growing up?
Well, actually, I have great memories of pluralism at its best. My friends were and are Hindus and Muslims, went to school, had people from, every religion possibly, and there was a sense of belonging and a sense of camaraderie that didn't have to do with our religious identities per se. And there was also a sense of celebrating each other's religious persuasions. For instance, I remember my neighbors were, you know, Muslim and Hindus, and we celebrated each other's festivals. You know, they would have Christmas trees in their houses with a star, you know, with a light bulb inside. And we would have goodies that we made for Christmas that we would take across. And Diwali, they would bring gifts, you know, like sweets and stuff like that. And of course, you know, everybody had fireworks that we set off. And so I have great memories of pluralism at its best growing up in India. It was really just, you know, probably in the last 30 years or 40 years that I started to notice increasingly a sense of a nationalism that I described.
In India as
in
well.
India, yeah.
What does it come from in India?
So, I mean, it is probably not a fair description to call it Hindu fundamentalism, because Hinduism is a very, very tolerant and wide religion. You know, religion. It's almost not fair to call it one religion. It's really a conglomerate of many different kinds of persuasions of spirituality that I think the British in some ways sort of put in one categoric monolithic, which it isn't. So I wouldn't want to, you know, characterize it per se. There are, however, proponents of this kind of fundamentalism who go back to the roots of saying India is for people who pursue a Hindu way, and so anybody else is not welcome here. That is sort of the ideology behind Hindutva, as it is called.
Hmm. And when you draw a parallel between the nationalism, perhaps white supremacy, white nationalism, and something like Brexit, some of our listeners are going to nod in agreement. Some of our listeners are going to hear that and say, that's a stretch. Why are you connecting Brexit to white nationalism, white supremacy?
Well, anytime one particular group tries to assert its identity as a superior identity, as a better identity, as a purer identity, it begins to categorize everybody else as less than. In the hierarchy, if you will, of epistemology or the ways in which we know by saying, you know, something is better and something is worse. And once you start making those contrasts, sociologically, you end up creating, at least in my context when I was growing up, what we call a caste system, where human beings are categorized socially. So there's a social stratification where the higher up you go, the purer you are. So within the classic understandings of Indian class caste system, you would have the Brahmin, who is the priestly person, who is, you know, purer than everybody else. He's the only one who can actually read Sanskrit, which is a holy text, etc. So when you start coming down with the Kshatriya, who's the warrior or the ruler, or the Shudra or the Vaishya, who's a business person, and then the Shudra, who's a laborer, and then the outcast, who's not even a part of the body politic of the caste system, because he or she is considered impure. So if you see the purity pollution categorization, it ends up socially manifesting itself in what we call the classic caste system.
Yeah, fair enough. And as you say, when you elevate a single identity, there's an idea that it is purer than others, that it condescends perhaps to others as less than. I can speak to this because I've had a lot of conversations in this community with people some who are, I think, reluctant to call themselves white nationalists, mm-hmm. and some who are proud to call themselves white nationalists. I think we are at a moment where that is much more prevalent than a lot of people would have guessed 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. But here it is. And so I think I can speak to the argument that they might make back to you, Bishop, which is that it's not necessarily about a culture or a race or an identity being purer. Mm-hmm. It's about preservation of a culture and identity that they feel might be sort of blended away in terms of white nationalism. This is where it gets really interesting, mm-hmm. because when it comes to identity politics, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about more in a moment, White nationalists don't shy from identity politics. They will tell you everything is identity.
Right.
And they see it as preservation of their identity.
Right.
What do you see it as?
Well, you know, sociologically, I can sit and discuss this with you, and we can go into the nuances and the weeds of how this is perceived. Identity politics is very real, and it's very large, and it's manifest in different places in different ways. So where I could go with my sense of being a religious person and a person who's striving to follow Jesus is to go to the example that he set by expressing a way to build a community that is about being beloved and about being inclusive and welcoming of all. Without that, I really have very little to offer a world which can easily pursue a way to normalize, a way to divide us. Because there are all kinds of reasons by which we can be divided, whether it's race, ethnicity, language. There is so much about what we call diversity that can be categorized or used for the purposes of becoming divisive, while the same things, the same characterizations can also become the best things that we have as people who bring different gifts, if you will, to the table. So that's why I would go back to, what does it mean for us to be community? What does it mean for us to be beloved community? And right there is room, I think, to tell truth to each other, listen with each other. There is room for us to build, reconnect the breaches that exist between us because we bring different worldviews. But then without following or without really making a commitment to follow a way of love, we could not get out of this quagmire, if you will, which stymies every human potential. Because every time we divide each other, we are reducing somebody. Right, so the loss, the human collateral damage, is profusely high. And as a person of faith, I want every person to actually live into their fullness of capacity and giftedness, so that they can actually be a blessing in the world.
Bishop, you've been in the United States for how many years now? You've been in Rochester 10 years, but
correct.
In the United States for how
about
long?
About 25 years.
Did you think that you would see a time where it felt quite like this when it comes to these divisions, the resurgence of nationalism, white nationalism? Did it surprise you?
I was surprised that it got to be so real in the United States. Because, Evan, the reality is, you know, growing up in India, one of the beacons that we had was something like the civil rights movement. For instance, "We Shall Overcome" is translated in many of the major Indian languages. That sense of the U.S. being a leader in integration, in what I call the beloved community, becoming beloved community, that image of the United States is very real. And so for me to come here and be a citizen of the United States and then to experience this kind of movement, forgetting all the milestones that we have crossed to get to this place of, in that sense of the word, being a beacon to the world, as a beacon of being the beloved community. Bring me your tired and your hungry. And that image of the United States was challenged in recent years.
So let's talk about the role of the church then. When I say the role of the church, we're talking about the institution of churches in our community, because you have been, as I said at the outset, a consistent voice in this community, whether it's helping lead a prayer service for families separated at the southern border or having these interfaith dialogues. But broadly speaking, maybe we'd be overgeneralizing here, but do you think the church, the Catholic Church, the Episcopal, the Baptist, whatever, is the church bringing people together, or is it allowing us to divide ourselves?
I think the church, and I think every religious body, has the capacity to bring people together. We in Rochester are very blessed to have a rich tradition and a rich practice of interfaith communications. So, in fact, all the community faith leaders in the community are very engaged and proactive in making sure that we build community. I think at the end of the day, any organization that is pursuing a religious path has to make a decision as to whether they want to be a part of the solution or stoke hate. Because while religious texts are available, they are available for us to use for purposes that are noble, that are about building rather than destroying. And so whenever religious texts are taken out of context and abused, they can have a very negative impact and cause more divisions and more alienation between us. So my sense is in the Episcopal Church, we have, you know, I'm for instance, an embodiment of the welcome of the Episcopal Church. I mean, 10 years ago, they elected me. And that is saying something in that sense of the word. The Episcopal Church, though located in very diverse places like Rochester, is a predominantly white church. And for them to actually be engaged in issues of racial justice, racial reconciliation, racial healing, is an indication that religious communities can, when they put their mind to it, be more about building beloved community and working to help, you know, heal the divisions that exist rather than stoke them and make them worse.
We'll take some of your emails, and they're starting to come in. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. My guest for the hour is the Right Reverend Dr. Prince Singh, the 8th Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester. And we're talking about a variety of issues and the Church's role in bridging these differences, healing divides, and bringing us together at a time where some of us don't feel very united. I want to play some of the remarks that we heard on the program earlier this week from a pastor of New City Fellowship in Rochester that really struck me and some of our listeners, Bishop. His name is Chris Holdridge. Pastor Holdridge is the pastor of New City Fellowship in Rochester, located in a neighborhood that has a lot of poverty. The conversation we were having was what would a post-Roe v. Wade America look like when it comes to the provision of abortion or not, what happens to families, children, etc. And Pastor Holdridge describes himself as very much, in his words, pro-life, but he says he's not really interested in Roe v. Wade right now because we're not doing a good enough job as a church and as a society in caring for the poor. And he had some very strong words when he surprised us by saying, you know what, when I think about Roe v. Wade, I don't care about it right now. It's not the focus. And in fact, he thinks legislation or a Supreme Court decision without any other cultural change would be a big net negative for women in poverty, for kids in poverty. Let's listen to some of what he had to say about that.
The degree of nihilism that exists in American poverty right now is not going to be solved by legislation, and it's not going to be solved by a few folks of means taking young black women under their wing and helping them. It's going to be changed by a movement of people who love and care and walk alongside of daily the poor in a life-on-life, everybody-gets-dirty situation. And that's how I want to see America love and take care of unborn children. And I'm telling you what, it's generations away.
That's strong words. And he said he can't help but feel cynical that we're generations away from truly caring for the poor in the way that Jesus himself would have cared for the poor. Do you agree with that?
Well, I certainly think that is a priority that we have lost, caring for the poor, even though, you know, as a nation, we have had several attempts, if you will. I don't really believe that we have made that a priority that is significantly engaged in that sense of the word. I was listening to some of Martin Luther King's words from the 60s when he was talking about the Poor People's Campaign and was trying to, you know, identify the three illnesses of the United States, which is racism, poverty, and militarism. All three basically go back to annihilating the human personality. And I believe while we have, you know, varied issues that are significantly important, and something like poverty has been with us for a long time. And for us as communities of faith, that is a priority that we have not necessarily engaged beyond primarily addressing some of the symptoms, if you will, in terms of, you know, taking care of feeding initiatives and gardens and so on, which are very good. I'm very proud that we have some very hands-on initiatives, but still, I don't believe our world in the United States is set up in a way that helps people who are poor to actually get out of poverty. For instance, in our education, which is one of the primary ladders out of poverty, I don't really believe we are able to provide the kind of support that is necessary for a child in poverty to actually get out of that, in that sense of the word. There are obviously exceptions to that, but as a nation, I don't believe we are doing a very good job of helping move out of poverty.
What do you think Jesus would say of mega churches and super wealthy pastors?
Well, you know, I think Jesus would have some choice words, you know, very simply.
It's hard to ask anyone to speak for Jesus. I understand putting you in a bad spot.
Well, I can only go back to what Jesus already has said.
Yeah, sure.
You know, Matthew 25, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was in prison. You came and visited me. It really comes down to very simply, what did you do? Not just what you believed, but what did you do? So that is what I think I hear Jesus.
I haven't read the Bible in a while. Is there anything about Maseratis or multiple fleets of sports cars for pastors in there? Not that you've seen?
Well, there's a lot about more, you know, mammon, which is material stuff.
Yeah.
And I think Jesus had some very, very pointed things to say about that.
Let me grab a phone call. This is Lila in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Lila.
Well, I'm a big listener of yours, Evan, and I'm just wondering, I hear you talk a lot about interfaith. Are you teaching also interfaith for respect for your Jewish community here? And I belong to Temple Beth Kodesh. I would love it if we could do something to get these things down in a very childhood way to start early.
It's a great question, Lila. Thank you. So Bishop Singh, on the interfaith question, do you reach out outside of Christianity? Do you reach out to your Jewish colleagues and friends?
We do. I don't want to say I reach out. I mean, I do my part. But I believe in Rochester, we have some terrific gifts. One of them is through the Hickey Center in Nazareth College.
Have you done some work with them?
I've done some work in terms of, you know, global integration, bringing children who are in high school together and helping have some conversations with them about the giftedness of difference and otherness, et cetera. And I think the caller is right in saying we need to start early with our children in terms of helping them understand that that community is built because there is a sense of trust that is practiced early. And once the muscle memory of practice is there, then there's a chance for us to actually build more from there. Because at the root of fear is a sense of not having the experiential. And when the experiential is replaced by speculation, fear moves in very quickly and it takes over. And then a whole different narrative gets going. So I'm really proud to belong to a community like Rochester where Jewish, Islamic, Hindu, Sikh, and Christian traditions actually interact with one another, not only in a symbolic way, but in some very practical ways, like in the global education offered through Nazareth.
We recently had a conversation with secular atheist and humanist friends here in Rochester about how they sort of see the state of things in the country. And One of the things that comes up when you talk to non-religious Americans, atheists or secular Americans, is that when they think about their friends who are religious, perhaps Episcopal, mm-hmm. Catholic, other faiths, they think about raising children within a faith tradition, which, of course, billions of people around the world do. And they think, boy, are those children being raised to think that if my friends in first grade are not also Jewish or are not also Episcopal, mm-hmm. are not also Muslim, that there's something lesser or wrong with them. Mm-hmm. How do you see that, Bishop? Because you're an Episcopal. I mean, mm-hmm. Episcopalian, this is what you believe about our world, mm-hmm. our creator. This is core to your being. So children, I imagine you want people in your church raising children in that faith tradition, but what happens when they start seeing their kids in class who aren't in their faith tradition as lesser or doing something wrong?
Well, I think fundamentally, religion gets to become more of an ideology when we start to do the superiority-inferiority piece. You know, my religion is more unique than yours, is of that kind of ilk, where you then start to say, you know, I'm better, and this is a better way. I don't think we need to do that. I mean, God is too expansive for us to sort of domesticate and say, okay, this is the ownership that we have of God. God is so loving and expansive and varied in that sense of the word, that there is room for us to have all kinds of engagements with the divine. And from that, to have traditions that follow this God in different ways. So God is one, in my opinion, with varied paths. You know, love is too big to be contained in one container, in that sense of the word. So I like to teach Episcopalians, and I believe we do, to recognize the human dignity of every person and to value the differences that they bring, not in any condescending way, but in a sense of curiosity. Because I think at the end of the day, when we lose sight of becoming curious, we tend to ossify or sort of get set in our ways, and then we don't really grow.
And that's so vital to teach children, it seems.
Exactly.
So they don't grow up thinking. You said it yourself. You used the word other, the way we sort of cast out or put our fears on the other. Mm-hmm. And religion could be a tool mm-hmm. to say, well, the other religions are lesser, are different, are something to be mocked. But it sounds to me like your message is the opposite.
Well, let me give you one example. Confirmation is a religious rite that most of our churches engage, and it is primarily a young person who is in high school who studies the tradition, so to speak, and then they make a public affirmation of why they believe the way they do, etc. And, you know, I, as a bishop, I get to lay hands on their heads and pray that God will strengthen them on their path, etc. Many of our confirmation classes now include an interfaith component where they go and visit a Jewish synagogue and interact and listen to people from there. They go to a mosque and sit and listen and learn. So we are increasingly encouraging our young people to recognize that being a global citizen means that the curiosity needs to be real. And so a part of the curriculum in some of our churches is an interfaith component. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, fascinating development and kind of an evolution of training. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Our guest for the hour is the Right Reverend Dr. Prince Singh, 8th Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester. And I've got a small pile of questions that have come in from our listeners. So we don't have 2 hours. We only have one with them, and it's going quickly. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back with Bishop Singh and get more of your questions in right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, how good is your history of Rochester? How much do you know about local history? What about LGBTQ historic landmarks? Would you be able to point them out? If you joined a walking tour, how much could you learn? The Landmark Society has put together just such a tour. They're trying to teach all of us about our own history that goes back decades in the LGBTQ movement. We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. All right, so let's get some listener feedback here for Bishop Singh. And first comes from Brenda, who says, Prince Singh. She says, ask him to tell the story of the fly in the communion cup under the tree in India. And I mentioned this during our brief break, and you're already laughing. What's going on? What's the story?
It's a story from India. And I was a priest in the Church of South India and had several congregations to take care of. One of the things in the church that we do regularly is nourish people through what we call communion, which is the bread and the wine. And it's a very central part of helping people recognize their belovedness and share a meal together in that sense of the word, to remember the sacrificial gift that God has given to us to love one another, right? So I was a newly minted priest in South India and had a little Vespa that I drove around to different places because I had 14 congregations take care of. One of them did not have a building. So on a very hot, humid, sunny afternoon, we met under a tamarind tree, which is a very shady tree. And I went around, gave the bread to people, and I came back and I picked up the cup and I noticed an ant swimming in the wine. And so I went to the first person, and the traditional words are blood of Christ, cup of salvation. And then I said, watch out. And then I went to the next person, blood of Christ, cup of salvation, watch out. Because I didn't know what else to say. And it took me about two or three people before I realized what I was saying. And then it occurred to me, yeah, you better watch out, because this is more than comfort food. That this is really asking you to be an agent of transformation. And that's what you need the strength for. So any engagement with faith means that we are called, in that sense of the word, to take the strength that we derive from our religious traditions and then use it for good. Use it to follow the way of love, which is really what Jesus was trying to teach and practice. So my sense is, you know, all of us have the capacity to be participants, to actively engage as agents of transformation in our own worlds.
That fly had a purpose for you.
Yes, it did.
I thought maybe you're saying watch out because the more people drink, the less liquid is in there and the more likely you are to gulp the fly. Also that.
I was trying to, it was an ant. I was trying to save the ant.
But what an interesting, and that's what makes, by the way, anybody who's spent any time in religious institutions, when you've got a great storyteller, someone who can understand how to send a message. Bishop Singh, that's why we've heard from some of the many who appreciate your work here, and they love stories like that. Let me read some more of our feedback here. Joel writes to us and says, what does your guest think of the Christians and especially evangelicals who are preaching about our stewardship of the earth? And what about those who don't practice it? And he says, what about the evangelicals who have said nothing about this president ever? Joel is referring to very strong numbers of evangelicals in the last election, especially white evangelicals, supporting President Trump. I don't know how comfortable you are getting into these questions because, you know, it gets to be pretty political. And I suspect you will have members of the church who come to you from different political backgrounds, and some maybe want more fire and brimstone about politics and some want less. So let me start broadly and then we'll get into Joel's specific questions. How comfortable are you about talking about politics these days?
Well, you have to engage politics because all of Scripture is political at the end of the day. As to whether it's party politics is probably the lens that I would want to be mindful of. At the end of the day, we are not called to pursue one way or the other way in terms of parties. But there is enough in the teachings of Jesus that actually gives us grist to engage in a very realistic way in the larger political questions of our time.
Okay. And so when Joel is asking, for example, evangelicals who preach about the stewardship of the earth and might not practice it, or evangelicals who supported this particular president. Any particular problems with that? How do you see that?
Well, anytime we endorse leadership of any persuasion at any level that dehumanizes anybody, when leaders begin to dehumanize, then you have to, you know, look at scripture and say, this is really not something that Jesus would promote or accommodate even. So I would really encourage anybody who is of any persuasion in the Christian faith to answer that question. You know, what, like you said to me earlier, what would Jesus do? And if, you know, whether you're an evangelical or otherwise, and you supported somebody with your sense of understanding that this could be good, and then you find out that there are expressions that are really contrary to some of what you really started off supporting somebody, then you need to stop and say, this is wrong, and this is why. So I would only, you know, ask to use the same lenses that probably prompted a movement in the first place.
Are you surprised at the evangelical support for this president?
I'm surprised at the silence and the sort of lack of accountability that I have always valued from evangelical leaders, where they were a voice of prophetic import, if you will, in calling a spade, so to speak. So to see so much radio silence from evangelical leaders and practitioners, and almost a sort of, we don't even want to notice what is going on, turning your eye away from what is expressed and practiced, etc. That is a concern. Whether it's an evangelical or anybody else, anybody who claims to be a follower of Jesus, I think we have to listen to the teachings of Jesus and use that as a way to say, okay, this is not right.
I don't even know if these questions are fair, to be honest with you, but when people ask, do you think this president is a Christian, I wonder if you think he is. Is that a fair question?
I don't know, because, you know, who is a Christian?
Yeah,
I mean, the if you go to the root of where Christians were named, if you look at the first few chapters in Acts of the Apostles, which is really an interesting book because it really talks about the actions of Christians in the early church, right? And if that is where in a town called Antioch, folks who looked at Christians said, you know, these fellows look like mini Christs, because they love each other so much. And that's where the title Christian came for the first time, because it was people who expressed themselves through the lens of the teachings and practices of Jesus. So if you use that lens and then say, okay, is somebody a Christian? You want to say, okay, is that person reminding me of Jesus or somebody else? That would be the litmus test, if you will.
Okay. Yesterday in Rochester, this is the subject of our second hour conversation today, the Landmark Society held a tour. About 100 people showed up, a walking tour in Rochester of LGBTQ landmarks. And one of the historians on that tour said that the Episcopal Diocese has become more progressive and supportive of the LGBTQ community here, but the Catholic Church has not. That was according to an LGBTQ historian in Rochester. Do you agree with that framing?
Well, I can only say that the Episcopal Church is very welcoming and has been for a long, long time. I can think of at least two or three predecessors of mine. I'm going back to Bishop Spears, who was a revered bishop of the Diocese of Rochester, and he was also a civil rights activist. He was very, very engaged, and I don't want to just say progressive, because he was more than progressive. He was really practicing ways of inclusion of LGBTQ persons, even in the 70s, before it became like an okay thing to do kind of thing. So it was a very prophetic diocese that I inherited and belonged to. And then, of course, later bishops, including Bill Burrell and Jack McKelvey, my predecessors, were very affirmative of the human dignity of LGBTQ persons. And, you know, in my tenure, I have also been very supportive and encouraging. We have some of the best leaders in the church who are gay or lesbian and transgender. You know, it is for us to then recognize the presence of God and the holiness of practicing the faith within these incredibly gifted people, and then make sure that they have all the protection that they need to function fully and equally in our church. So if you take our governance in the Episcopal Church, we have people who are LGBTQ across the various levels of leadership, so to speak.
That's the leadership. What about the members of the church? Have you had any pushback?
I wouldn't say, you know, pushback from a sense of homophobia,
okay,
if I can be
sure,
clear about that. I think the pushback is in some places, especially in some of our rural towns, where there hasn't been a lot of engagement. You know, Evan, it does come down to relationships. Until I got to meet people who are LGBTQ, I did not know them. I was only speculating, right? But once I started to get to know them, you know, Bob and Hiram were the couple that I first engaged. And it was in the relationships that we built from getting to know each other that later on I found out that our younger son, who when asked around his confirmation who he wanted to be his sponsors, he said Bob and Hiram, because he saw something of the face of God in these two wonderful people. I think if you don't have that experience of getting to know somebody, I would encourage you to do so. Go ahead and make a connection, you know, and it matters, it makes sense across the board. If it's racial divisions,
yeah,
et cetera,
absolutely.
Bring them into your kitchen table, have a meal together, and then your relationship will change. I think we change because we get to know people.
Absolutely.
It is as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, how many people do we know who opposed equal marriage and then all of a sudden their child is gay and they see the world in a different way?
Right.
And yes, for those who fear the other of any kind, mm-hmm. breaking bread together is a very powerful thing. Have you experienced personal racism much in the United States?
Well, I would be naive to say I have not. But I also want to say that, you know, for every time that I have felt something of a discrimination of some sort, I have a ton of other experiences where I have felt the grace and the dignity that is offered me as a person and to us as a family. With the Episcopal Church, you know, I want to come back to that just for a brief minute to say, you know, has really strived to practice what we have been preaching for a long time. We're certainly not a perfect community. We still have a way to go. But there are indications of really engaging and prioritizing what is important. So for instance, in the 10 years that I have been here, one of the things that I've had to do is to look around and say, you know, what do we need to stop doing? You know, so we had to make some very big changes. Some of them were pretty radical. You know, we sold a house that was on East Avenue, which sort of symbolized a little bit about who we were. And that was a pretty, you know, important decision that we made. And we made that because we said, you know, we want to be about being missional in that sense of being out in the neighborhood, being engaged in missional stuff that is about restoring people's dignity, etc. This mansion on East Avenue is not saying that in a very clear way. It, in fact, is saying something about a past that is not there anymore in that sense. So we made some decisions like that. I, you know, had to make some staff changes, etc. And through all of that, my sense is that people were a lot more curious about leadership, my leadership, because I'm different, right? I mean, I stand out. I don't need to say a whole lot, you know, for people to recognize that I'm a different kind of guy in that sense of the word. And so for a community to accommodate that leadership and receive that, I did have some pushback initially, but they were also willing to say, we need to change, because at the end of the day, we are only about the practice of love. And if we can get clearer about that and let the clutter out, then we can be a better community. A better church will make a better community.
Bishop Singh, you've been in the United States for roughly 25 years. An American citizen for how long?
10 years.
10 years. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means it's a responsibility. I have to participate. I cannot be a bystander. And so I need to speak when I need to speak, when I notice things. I need to do something about things that are broken in our system. And I need to be a part of helping heal the wounds and the divisions that exist in our world.
On this program yesterday, I spoke to an American who married a woman from South Korea. And they live now again in Western New York. And she is a naturalized citizen and went through the entire process. And he said, you know, people really just don't, who haven't gone through it, don't understand just how extensive and arduous it can be. Mm-hmm. But he also was really keen to and sort of sensitive to the conversations in which we dog whistle a lot about true Americans, what does it mean to be an American, in the ways we talk about other countries. And he said, look, I lived in South Korea. I taught in South Korea. I married a woman from South Korea. They are becoming more multicultural now. And yes, for many years, they were not. But they are. That countries around the world are becoming more open societies now. But our country is maybe the most and the most multicultural and the most celebrated of our differences. But how are we going to get to a point where being American, especially for white Americans, that we don't have this dog whistle that, well, you know, being an American looks like one thing, because we are a country that is multicultural. It's multi-background, and we are, I unabashedly say that that makes us stronger.
It does.
But this is a tough moment. Mm-hmm. How are we going to change some of that perception that is out there that says there's no single meaning to being an American? What does it mean to be an American? What do we say about that?
Well, as with any crisis, there is an opportunity. I think the current crisis is accentuating the opportunity that we have as a people. As Americans, we have the opportunity to claim our sense of who we are. And I think that is the crisis that we are facing at this moment. Are we going to sort of the quote-unquote good old days of feeling like, you know, it's a white America in that sense of the word? Or are we going to live into what it means for us to be the most pluralistic and harmonious country in the world? I think that is the opportunity that we have at the current moment, politically, sociologically, ideology-wise, etc. But it's a question of whether there are enough people who will claim that and then make the necessary changes that need to accompany that, so that we don't sort of do the vacillating between, you know, nationalism and other ways of being.
Are you an optimist?
Oh, yeah. I'm very much...
You strike me as an optimist.
I'm very much an optimist. I cannot be a person of faith without being optimistic.
But you don't feel at moments any cynicism or doubt or...
Oh, yes. Like everybody, you know, I too have my moments. But I think that's where I go back to my faith. And I say, you know, at the end of the day, God calls us, all of us, to behave like God's children. And if I can value the dignity of every human being around me and do the practices that are about practicing a way of love and, you know, proclaiming that sense of optimism about the dream of God that we have, then I can get out of the malaise and the sort of anything that detracts me or us as communities to build a beloved community.
Down to our last minute or so. So forgive me, is this home for a while for you? Is this it? Are you going to stay in Rochester?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't have Rochester on my radar
11 years ago. Yeah.
So, you know, I do certainly believe in God leading me where I need to be. And for the moment, it is Rochester.
And so what's the next big idea or project or thing you want to see happen here in our community to make the community stronger?
Well, I think the interfaith community, the Rochester Interfaith Network Alive, is reimagining itself to be more of a network, so that we are not only, you know, coming out with proclamations when there's a crisis, but that there will be a lot more of an engaged involvement in the community in a networking kind of way, so that we accommodate and are led by local leaders from the grassroots who are making a difference in the world.
Yeah, I'd like to apologize that this is our first visit together since I started hosting this program. I'm sorry about that. Let's not wait so long for the next.
Let's not. It's been a delight to be with you. It's a terrific opportunity, and I thank you for your work of helping transform this world.
Well, thank you. And Bishop Singh, real briefly, where will our listeners find you? They want to come meet you in person.
Well, I'm around. I go to a different Episcopal church every Sunday, and usually my itinerary is on the website, and Steve, our able communications person, can make that a little more prominent.
Well, thank you for taking the time, and I know I will see you soon.
Thank you, Evan. Well.
That's the 8th Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester, the Right Reverend Dr. Prince Singh. Short break, more connections coming up.